From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, October 19th through Friday, October 23rd, 2020, a week of upticks, downticks, and the ticking of the clock as the presidential election of our lifetimes draws to a dramatic climax and we find ourselves poised to enter what will undoubtedly be a new era, no matter which way the voting goes. Stand by as we're about to be joined by people with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices, sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation, all part of the verbal stew in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, let's start chewing the fat. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, a tie between Rush Limbaugh's advancing illness and the Jeffrey Toobin scandal. Rush Limbaugh sparked a lot of conversation in the media about the state of his health and the importance of his career to talk radio by candidly discussing setbacks he's suffering in his battle against stage 4 lung cancer on his show on Monday.
And CNN legal analyst and New Yorker magazine writer Jeffrey Toobin ran into embarrassing trouble that caused him to be suspended from his jobs by accidentally exposing himself and engaging in a lewd act during a Zoom meeting with colleagues, not realizing the camera was on and not off. Heads up to parents, you might not want your children listening toward the end of this hour when we discuss the topic in more detail.
At number 9, U.S.-China relations. It was apparent during the debate on Thursday that leaders of both parties recognized the multiple dangers posed to the security and worldwide interests of the United States by the Chinese Communist Party.
Especially with Trump and Biden accusing each other of being soft on Beijing, or worse, actually being in bed financially with China.
At number 8, the Google antitrust suit tied with Twitter and Facebook being investigated for political bias. The Justice Department filed a landmark antitrust suit against the internet behemoth.
And the Senate Judiciary Committee stepped up its probe of Facebook and Twitter as these social media platforms are accused of bias for censoring information regarding the New York Post story about allegedly damaging information revealed on Hunter Biden's hard drive and the emails it purportedly contained, indicating corruption in his dealings with Ukraine and China.
At number 7, the Pope's support of gay marriage tied with Purdue Pharma pleading guilty for its role in the opioid crisis. Pope Francis broke with long-standing Vatican teachings on the issue by endorsing same-sex civil unions, stating, "Homosexual people have the right to be in a family. They are children of God."
And drug giant Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, has agreed to plead guilty to 3 federal criminal charges for its role in creating the nation's opioid crisis. It'll cost them approximately $8 billion, and they'll close down the company. The money will go to opioid treatment and abatement programs.
At number 6, race relations, law and order, and police reform. Again, as evidenced in Thursday night's debate, America's reckoning on race is one of the major issues defining the year 2020 and the presidential election.
And of course, that ties into the talk that African-American parents describe having with their children, instructing them on how to safely conduct themselves during any encounters they might have with police, such as being pulled over for a traffic violation or walking across the street in a hoodie.
At number 5, the Supreme Court confirmation process. It certainly appears at this point that Amy Coney Barrett is on a fast track to being confirmed by the Senate to fill the court's vacant seat, to the delight of Republicans and the dismay of Democrats.
And Joe Biden's stance on the issue of court packing, which he now states would be looked into by a bipartisan committee should he be elected, remains a hot issue in the presidential race.
At number 4, the economy, a second stimulus package, business openings, and the education crisis. The second, and what some people are calling the third wave of the coronavirus, is throwing obstacles in the path of an economic recovery, as people desperately await a second stimulus package still tied up in Congress. And the dreaded fall and winter resurgence of the disease is making it difficult to open schools and get students back into the classroom learning process.
First-time claims for unemployment benefits inched lower this past week, according to the Department of Labor, with 787,000 workers filing for benefits, marking the first time jobless claims fell below 800,000 since mid-March. But not everyone is eligible for regular state benefits. Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, PUA, which Congress created as part of the CARES Act in the spring, provides benefits for the self-employed and gig workers. 345,440 people applied for PUA this past week.
At number three, accusations of scandals and corruption, including the Hunter Biden emails and Trump's Chinese bank account. As indicated earlier, the final 2 weeks of the race to Election Day are being marked by each side accusing the other of shady business practices and corruption, especially in relationships with foreign governments.
As to whether these discussions and revelations are moving the needle in terms of undecided voter reaction outside the bubble universes of partisan talk media remains to be seen.
At number two, COVID-19 stats and projections, healthcare, vaccines, and the worsening psychological state of the American people. There was a setback in the quest to find and approve a safe and effective COVID-19 vaccine with the death of a volunteer in one of the tests. In other developments, on a more positive note, the FDA approved the antiviral drug remdesivir for use in adult and pediatric patients 12 years and older for the treatment of COVID-19 requiring hospitalization.
At the time this program is being produced on Friday, there are 8.46 million diagnosed cases of COVID-19 in the United States, and 223,000 Americans have died.
And at number one this week, the presidential race, including Thursday night's debate, ballot issues, polls, and foreign election tampering. The race is in full swing and the nation is on the edge of its collective seat as we come into the home stretch with less than 2 weeks to go before Election Day.
And as clearly indicated by its prominent position in Thursday night's presidential debate, COVID-19, along with its impact on America's economy, social norms, psyche, and grief, has been and continues to be the major driving concern of the nation here in the remarkably challenging year 2020. No matter how you spin it, dead lives matter. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. The excitement, tension, and drama of the presidential race is boiling over as we draw closer and closer to Election Day, while millions of people have already cast their ballots or are in the process of doing so. It came to a crescendo on Thursday night with the final face-to-face debate between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. I caught up with legendary radio talk show host Mike Siegel, heard at our affiliate KFNX Phoenix, the pulse of Arizona. Mike, Arizona has become a real political hotspot. What's your assessment of it?
Michael, it's compelling is the word I would use, because it is the centerpiece of this election cycle. Not only the president, who was here twice earlier in the week in two separate locations in Prescott and Tucson, but also the McSally-Kelly race. It's a very interesting race because if Kelly wins, because this is a special election since she was appointed, he takes office November 30th. And so it's much sooner than the rest of the Senate. So that changes the lay of the land as far as that goes. And with the Senate being so close, this could be a crucial race for Martha McSally to win re-election, to officially have the seat on her own rather than by appointment. So that's been a huge part of this. The COVID-19 has been huge here, with ironically having gone from being the highest rate in the country to the lowest a month later because we did our work and did what we had to do. Now it's come back a little bit, so we'll see how that plays out. But it's a very interesting time all over the country, and in Arizona especially so because of this election.
I know that you tend to be conservative, and I know the last few times we've talked, you support the president. But since you talk about COVID and you've seen it come and go and come in Phoenix, how do you feel the president's posture on COVID serving him in terms of his reelection?
I think the president has and his campaign have been ineffective in conveying the message of what they've done. I mean, look what he did. He brought in all of the major pharmaceutical companies, other companies that transferred from doing the work they were doing. A good example is Mike Lindell at the MyPillow company. They started making masks. The president got a number of private companies to do enormous work. We're talking about tens of thousands of ventilators. He built the ship as a hospital for Andrew Cuomo in New York. He also took the Javits Center, and the military turned that into another hospital. Cuomo never used it, either one, yet he sent people back into the nursing homes who had COVID-19, and the numbers that I've read indicate over 6,000 people died because he did that. Yet nobody takes him to task, and everybody takes the president to task, who did all the work to get all these materials, 500 million masks and lots of other gowns for our frontline workers. The problem has been a lack of communication effectively about this. I understand from some people I've talked to who knew the president, and his niece has confirmed this, that his grandfather apparently injected in him the notion that you do not ever take negatives. You put them aside and you do the positives. So he didn't want to apparently confront talking about COVID-19. My point would be, if he talked about it and reinforced his empathy for people with respect to the work that he had done, tangibly done, he could talk about, it would have been far more effective. His problem has been a lack of communication of what he's done, not so much what he's done.
And you attribute that to perhaps the influence of his grandfather, as opposed to maybe other things within the campaign or the organization or even his personality that are getting in the way?
Yes. And in fact, even his own wife can't stop him from his tweets. His family, he just is his own person. He does things the way he wants to do them. And as a result, sometimes it's great and sometimes creates a problem. He had a great message on COVID-19 for what he did. He closed down the country, Michael, January 31st from the Chinese. He then closed it down from Europe. He did the right things. He hasn't communicated that effectively.
How do you answer critics who say that he only did a partial closing for China and that Europe was very porous and most of the East Coast's problems at the beginning of this year came from Europe? I mean, that's what critics of the president say. I'm sure that you've been confronted with that. What's your answer?
Well, first thing is, the people he let back into the country from China were 40,000 Americans. I mean, as he put it. And he said this properly and effectively. What are you going to do? Keep Americans from coming back? You can't. So the Americans came back from China. That was appropriate. With respect to Europe, that's a massive job. He ordered it shut down. But he didn't go out there on a day-to-day basis monitoring and being at the airports or on the cruise ships doing it personally. Mm. But he did the right thing, carried out the right policy. If, in fact, the execution was not as effective as it should have been, and then really, I suppose the buck stops here, and he's responsible for that. But the bottom line is, he put the right policy in place. It just wasn't carried out effectively.
Now, this conversation is taking place on Wednesday of this past week. Of course, tomorrow night, Thursday, which will be old news by the time this runs on the weekend, is the I guess the second debate. I think of it as the third debate because the dueling town halls were sort of a weird quasi-debate. How do you think the president did in the first debate, and what suggestions would you give him? Again, we don't know the result yet, but at this point in time, going into the Thursday night debate.
First thing I would say is that he was overbearing and that people don't like that kind of controversy. Because what they care about is more about their own needs and interests. He has an incredible story to tell. Orrin Hatch made the point, a fabled United States senator who was there for many decades in the Senate from Utah, that this president has, even back then when he said it over a year ago, has accomplished more than any president in history. I would argue the same, except perhaps George Washington for his having created the stability for this country to exist in his 8 years as president. And Abraham Lincoln, who got us through a civil war and kept us together, which was amazing, actually, with over 600,000 lives lost. But this president has done more than anyone else but them, arguably. And unfortunately, he doesn't let that play out. He has to keep pounding it and reminding people of it and then interfere with Biden during that debate. I thought it was a catastrophe. I think he could have just said, look what we've done. laid it out calmly and professionally, and people want to hear that. I think he lost because of that debate. I think he lost the debate because he was too overbearing, and people don't want that. They're tired of the antagonism. They want a little bit of peacefulness, understanding, and nurturing with regard to COVID-19, and also on all these other issues. Yeah, make the point, but make it responsibly and without becoming a thug, which is frankly what he did in that debate.
That's radio talk show host Mike Siegel of our Phoenix affiliate KFNX, the Pulse of Arizona. Coming up next, insights into the government's antitrust suit against Google and inquiries into the accusation of political bias against Facebook and Twitter. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career: Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. There's been a ton of conversation this past week about digital era communications. The Justice Department has filed a landmark antitrust suit against Google, and the Senate Judiciary Committee is going after Facebook and Twitter for their blocking the New York Post story about Hunter Biden's email brouhaha. Joining us now is Bentley University Boston Professor of Law and founder of Scamicide.com, Steve Wiseman. Steve, we have a bunch of stories that fall into your wheelhouse. Iran and Russia interfering in our elections, Google facing an antitrust suit, and Facebook and Twitter being scrutinized by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Where do you want to start?
You know, they're all terrific, but one of the big ones is the Iran and Russia seeking to influence the election. I mean, it was quite an unprecedented press conference with the FBI director, the director of national intelligence, and others indicating the attempts by both Russia and Iran to influence the vote. I think one of the biggest facts that got left out, I mean, you see these headings. You hear the criticisms by some of the election and the security of the election. And then if you actually find out what the intelligence community said was that, no, the voter registration data was not hacked. Believe it or not, this kind of data is actually, and perhaps we should have some laws, it's gathered and for sale by the various states and local authorities. They put that up. And
you're kidding me.
Campaigns by this, others were doing for advertising by this. And in fact, that's what happened. So Iran and Russia got this information, not from hacking, but from buying it. And what they're doing with it is, at the moment, we don't know where they're going to go, but at the moment, they're sending out phony emails that are trying to influence the election. So instead of what we saw in 2016, the phony ads in the social media, now we're seeing emails, some that appear to threaten people if they vote in a certain way, others filled with misinformation. So the two big takeaways are, one, yeah, any election system is vulnerable, but two, we need to really let the people know, one, to be wary and skeptical of emails you get, and two, to know that there hasn't been a hacking of the election system.
Wow. So the states are selling our stuff. They're selling our private information.
Yep. So it's a combination in two ways. They actually, anyone, including Iran and Russian, I won't even call them hackers, we'll just say cyber criminals, all they have to do is buy it from legitimate sources, or they're also, there's a part of the internet called the dark web. Fascinating place where the cyber criminals buy and sell goods and services. And there have been appearing not just some of those readily available lists that could be sold, but someone did some additional work and attached email addresses from other, again, publicly available databases, and those are being sold on the dark web as well.
So it's not just Russia and Iran. Even domestic organizations can wage email campaigns of disinformation designed to disorient voters.
Oh, bingo. And you know, that's something in my media law class I mentioned a lot earlier in the year, and in the year since 2016, you know, a lot of people were talking about the misinformation that appeared particularly on Facebook with phony groups and ads that were set up by Russian intelligence. Preying on sometimes our lack of, although our intelligence community really does a good job. But sometimes we as Americans aren't quite skeptical enough. But all of that, and I'll just call it what it is, it's garbage. All of that garbage could have been put up by Americans, and it wouldn't have violated any laws. So, this is nothing new.
Well, is it a violation of law for Iran and Russia to do that? Do we have any legal platform to stand on in terms of dealing with them?
Yes, we do. Well, that's the tough part. It is illegal for foreign countries to buy ads and attempt to influence our election here. Mm-hmm. That is a violation. The question comes is always, what do we do about it? And it's like the old, don't make me come up there, you know, one more time. Don't do that. Just recently, the Justice Department indicted a number of Russian hackers, serious Russian hackers. These are guys that hacked into the French election and did a great job, as a matter of fact, of dealing with that misinformation. These are the people that were interfering with the 2016 election and all kinds of other hacks around the world. But so what? We indict them. We do what's called public shaming. And we have a saying here in Boston, good luck to you and the Red Sox. I mean, that isn't going to really do anything. We do need to have much more serious, real financial sanctions against these countries. You know,
right.
They deny. But the bottom line is our intelligence is really good when it comes to tracking these things. They've found them. They've identified even the people who are involved in it. And we need, as a country, to show in not a paper tiger and to take some serious sanctions against Russia, Iran, North Korea, China, and any other countries who attempt to use cyber espionage. I mean, these countries, and particularly China will attack American companies and steal intellectual property. You want to talk about hurting the economy and hurting jobs.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing.
Yeah, well, that's an issue that we're quite aware of, and it's a little bit of a different issue than just election tampering. Yeah, when I brought you on, I asked the question, you know, I was surprised, you know, the Russians are against Trump all of a sudden. When did that happen? And I can understand why Iran would be. And then I'm thinking as you're speaking, and I'm also thinking to some of the knowledge that I've acquired over the last 24 hours. And maybe it's not to support any candidate, but rather just to create instability in terms of Americans' confidence in our democracy. Do you think that that's the underlying reason for this recent spate of fraudulent emails from Iran and Russia? Not so much to get Trump in or out, but to just create confusion and lessen the confidence of the American public in our system. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct with that. I don't think there's any question, really. Russia does prefer to have Trump as the president. And there's no question Iran definitely does not want Trump as the president.
But right.
Both of them. And I think you're absolutely 100% right. And this is something that a lot of people have missed. They call this perception hacks. So what it was done like here was taking easily accessible data and creating the impression that the integrity of our system is not working. It's not there. They want the country to be divided. They want the country to be in disarray. They want the country not to be the United States and to, as you say, just shatter the confidence and make us a paper tiger no matter who wins.
I hate to say, but to a certain extent, they're succeeding. We do have a lack of confidence in our institutions, in our democratic institutions, in our elections, in our processes. We were talking that we're going to be getting into this whole antitrust suit against Google. That's a difficult thing to do because nobody pays to use Google. How could you possibly have a monopoly when the people that are using your service do so voluntarily?
Yeah, and once again, that's a terrific argument because what a lot of people don't realize is there are monopolies and there are illegal monopolies. In order to be an illegal monopoly and violate antitrust law, you have to harm consumers. And as you indicated, the fact that you don't pay for Google, you get all of this service, and you're not paying for it, it's hard to argue that indeed consumers have been harmed by this. So, you know, for instance, I looked at the actual government complaint here, which is, pretty lengthy. And one of the things that they said was, that somehow the price of other consumer products is affected by the high advertising rates that Google is able to charge these companies. And so that is going to be a real stretch to try and find that as to be actually harming consumers. First of all, this isn't going to turn around tomorrow. It's going to be years before there's any kind of a resolution. And if history is any kind of guide, Google's been sued before by the federal government in 2011 over privacy concerns. They paid, which for Google was pretty meager, $22.5 million settlement. They were sued over child's privacy rights on YouTube. Again, it was $170 million settlement. And here again, that's pocket change for Google, which also brings up generally, in my white collar crime class, we talk about when someone like is charged with insider trading, and you go up against the government, you're going up against deep pockets. They've got much more money, and they can get the lawyers that they want. When you're going up against Google, in fact, Google had just reserves of cash of close to $18 billion, and the entire budget for the Justice Department's antitrust division is $167 million. So if you want to bet on who's got the deep pockets, you got to bet on Google.
Oh, my gosh.
And, I think this is a hard case to win. I think that ultimately both sides will claim to win. Google will make some minor adjustments, but they're not going to change, and they're still going to be the big dog.
My gosh, it's like the scene from The Godfather 2. Michael, we're bigger than U.S. Steel. It's Google, we're bigger than the U.S. government. So just as a human being with a pretty good brain, forget all the legal stuff. Is it problematic? Is it worrisome that Google has such awesome power?
You know, it always is a sense. There is always a sense of concern, and certainly, people want to be confident that what they're getting is accurate, helpful service and not misinformation and not being harmed. But quite frankly, I'm less concerned about Google's being a monopoly. And here again, it was, you know, one of the founders of Microsoft once said, "We don't have a monopoly. We just have a big big share of consumers." And I'm not as involved. I don't see the harm that is coming. I think what we're seeing here is a political argument between politicians who may find that they are threatened by the tech companies and the power that the tech companies have. But, you know, quite frankly, I don't see that threat as that serious.
Along those lines, in conclusion, I'll let you go. Do you think the same situation is with Facebook and Twitter, who are under pressure from the government, that they are biased against politicians and certain politics? My reaction as a fan of the First Amendment is maybe they are, but it's not illegal for a private platform to be biased. What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. I'm not even sure that they're biased. I do think they are trying to make good decisions on this, and they're realizing that just allowing their algorithms to do so isn't enough, that they have to have really sophisticated people looking at this. But, you know, the funny thing here is the president has often criticized Facebook and Twitter and said that he wants to take away certain provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And one of those was saying that there's a provision in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. If someone posts something on a site, the site is not responsible for any misinformation on there unless they are aware of the fact that this is misinformation, it's a copyright infringement or whatever, and then doesn't take it down. So the president has said that he wants to take away that kind of protection. Well, if he took away that kind of protection, the Facebook and Twitters would have to do a much stronger job of not allowing things to go on their sites, such as the Hunter Biden story, which, you know, quite frankly, bears a lot of the same indications of many Russian misinformation programs here in the United States. So, you know, be careful what you wish for, Mr. Trump and other politicians like that, because you may find more fact-checking by people that you may disagree with.
That's Bentley University Boston professor of law and founder of Scamicide.com, Steve Wiseman. Still to come, a psychiatrist looks at the wave of despair that has reached epidemic proportions in the United States, and a prominent member of the White House press corps talks about covering presidents then and now, as well as the state of journalism. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Attention homeowners, spending more time around your house means you're putting more stress on major appliances that keep your home running. Like many Americans, a major breakdown could be very costly during these uncertain times. AC unit goes, that's $4,500. Water heater breaks, $1,500. When you own a home, it's always something. If you have a home warranty, those repairs could cost you nothing. A Home Service Club warranty pays for the repair or replacement of your home appliances and systems when they break down, even from normal wear and tear. For about $1 a day, you can cover your home appliances and systems. It's not a question of if they'll break down, it's when. If you call now, you'll get your first month free and $75 off your first year. Make home appliance repairs one less thing to worry about. Call 800-259-1604 now for your free quote, free first month, and $75 off your first year. 800-259-1604 now. That's 800-259-1604. Again, 800-259-1604.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. The coronavirus pandemic isn't the only ailment dragging down Americans. Statistics indicate COVID-19 has sparked the spread of an epidemic of depression, despair, and emotional discomfort among the population coast to coast. Joining us now is prominent forensic psychiatrist Dr. Renee Kohansky, whose podcast, MD Edge Psychcast, is listened to by mental health care professionals.
There's a lot going on for people in the year of 2020, and there's a big difference between depression and not feeling particularly happy and feeling overwhelmed by circumstances. So not all unhappiness and not all, for lack of a better word, not all, using your word actually, not all despair is depression. I would say there's an increase in maybe feelings of sadness and maybe feelings of utter frustration and this kind of sense of foreboding that's happened in the year of 2020. And some of it has manifested in increased actual clinical symptoms of depression. But overall, I think where you were going with that, and I have to absolutely agree with you, is what we are seeing across our nation and maybe even perhaps across the world is an increase in unhappiness and uncertainty and fear that is a direct result of how the COVID or coronavirus has hit us and the incredible devastation, which is, I think, not even directly as a direct cause of the virus, but the collateral damage of the virus, which, by the way, I think there's a lot we can do about.
We can do about it? In other words, you have a remedy for the problem?
Well, I think understanding the problem will help people feel better about what's going on. If you understand what it is that's making you feel so bad, then you can understand, then that can kind of help you feel better about why you feel so bad.
What about the old saying, misery loves company? Is there a certain comfort in knowing you're not alone, that this is widespread?
There's comfort in knowing that there's a reason for it, that
reason.
It's not in your head, and that you are justified in feeling the way you are. And if I could just directly address that, we've been cooped up for 9 months, and we've been getting incredibly conflicting information about what's true and what's not true. And what's more, our eyes are telling us one thing, and we're getting information that's saying another thing. And we're also living in a world that's changed more each day than it has ever before, to include, perhaps, if I may dare, to include changing the way we've always been with regard to how we express ourselves. And that's, in our country, one of the most important things that we have.
Yeah, the political correctness has proven to be unhealthy for many people who feel they have to walk on eggshells. Of course, you know, it's always good to be concerned about not hurting people and not being totally out of the times. But these times have changed so quickly, a lot of people are feeling quite disoriented culturally and socially. I find that one of the things that's causing despair, depression, sadness, and worry, you know, people are worried, is the economic situation. More and more people are either out of work, they're unemployed, their businesses are closing, they don't know if they're going to get a stimulus check. The economy, as much as we want to say, you know, it's roaring back, some people say, others say we're on the verge of a depression. You hear all kinds of information, but the reality is a lot of people can't meet their rent, and that that'll certainly take away the joy of living.
And add to that the experience that it doesn't have to be that way, and also that it's arbitrary, so that there are restaurateurs in New York City, for example, who live on one street, and they're allowed to open their restaurants, and then there are people who live one block over, and they're not allowed to open their restaurants, and there really is no, you know, there's no particular... You know, obviously there are COVID outbreaks, so you understand why there might be a reason to close a restaurant. But when you're on one block and you can't open it, and you're on another block and you can, it seems rather arbitrary. And there's a lot of frustration over things like that. So there's a feeling like, yes, I understand that I can't work, but it really doesn't actually make sense why I can't work. So if there were an economy that were crashing for natural reasons, it's one thing, but when it's crashing and we feel like it's artificially induced, it's more frustrating.
Right, and it becomes political, and then it becomes controversial and confrontational. Also,
yeah, confrontational, very, very accurate.
I find also that relationships are being strained, but not just people stuck together finding out they don't have a great marriage, or maybe learning they do have a good marriage, or, you know, grandparents missing their grandchildren, all of that type of thing that's going on. But I hear, I read that there is a spike in the number of people who are in severe trouble because of domestic violence that has come along with this cabin fever.
And I would say that's because we are, I don't want to get too technical, but there's a really interesting psychological paradigm that could explain it, so I'm not going to go there. But what I think it has to do with is that the society holds us together. Like, there's not just there's the family dynamic that holds us together, but also the society. So when you have a society that's literally falling apart at the seams, when you see that the society is breaking down, people are on the street literally beating each other up for no good reason, that is serving a destabilizing effect, not just in that situation where the people are rioting, but it's also, and nothing is being done about it, by the way, but it's sending a message across every single system, to include the family system. So that's absolutely true that we're seeing an increase in domestic violence, and it's sad. And there's also, by the way, the supports that used to hold domestic violence in abeyance are also collapsing to some degree, and that's something that we need to decide. Do we want to tolerate this or not?
That's noted forensic psychiatrist Dr. Renee Kohansky of the medical profession podcast MD Edge Psychcast. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. With the presidential election dominating the national conversation, the White House has become the central focus of the nation and its concerns, both literally and figuratively. We're joined now by a radio TV journalism professional who's been covering the White House for decades, representing such news organizations as Fox News Channel, CNN and CNN Radio, NBC News Radio, and most recently, Westwood One. He's a graduate of Syracuse University's prestigious Newhouse School of Journalism. Now he runs his own recently launched independent radio news service called Ear on the White House, Bob Costantini. The following is an excerpt from a long-form conversation I had this week with Bob that'll be posted this coming Tuesday on my weekly podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview. Final question. This will be posted and broadcast before the election, which is, at the time we're doing this, only a couple of weeks away. There's a lot of concern about it being a difficult election. There's a lot of concern about it taking forever maybe to determine who the winner is. And there's concern about the peaceful, transition of power. What are your thoughts looking at this election? What do you think what's in store for us?
I'm not as much of a naysayer as some people are. And you have people on both sides who insist that this is going to take days and weeks and maybe even months and involve a lot of court battles. I'm not necessarily thinking that that's going to be the case. The courts will try as little as possible to intervene in the collection of votes and the counting of votes. Anybody who's old enough to remember, and of course you and I are, 2000, what happened when the Supreme Court had to decide, basically determine the winner of the 2000 election by the 500 and some votes, George W. Bush in Florida. I don't think really that the courts are going to interfere that much in the states. You can call me Pollyanna, if you will, about this, but the Trump and Biden campaigns are prepared with a lot of lawyers to argue these things out. I think you know, the Constitution makes very clear that there is no one way of counting votes when it comes to a national election, and the courts will be loath to get involved with the individual states who have their ways. It is left up to the states about the systems of voting and about how they're counted, absentee ballots, and of course now we have the whole notion of a few states, and only one of them is actually a battleground, that have been sending out ballots to every person on the voter rolls, which is something the president has railed against. But I don't think, and of course, if I'm wrong, I'll come back and talk to you about how wrong I was, but I don't think it is going to be dragged out all that long with this. Remember who calls the election, by the way. Yeah, on election night, generally, it is not some grand person in Washington, D.C. or whatever. It's the Associated Press and the television networks who call it based on their exit polling and the information that they have.
Thank you, Bob Costantini of Ear on the White House. If you'd like to hear the entire interview from which that conversation was excerpted, it'll be posted this coming Tuesday morning at mhinterview.com. There's time to squeeze in one more. The embarrassing masturbation scandal that engulfed CNN legal analyst and New Yorker magazine writer Jeffrey Toobin was the gossip buzz of talk media this past week. Joining us now is our international woman in the nation's capital, Victoria Jones. Some people are approaching it as a political story because he is part of CNN and they're, you know, ensconced in politics. And some people are seeing it as somewhat of a Me Too type story. What are your thoughts?
It seems to be a combination of all of these and also a COVID-19 story.
Yes.
As well. It's sort of a mishmash of everything. And sort of, you know, Jeffrey Toobin is a very big name personality. And I think it's just so astonishing to many people that here you've got somebody who's obviously very familiar with Zoom calls, because by this time, you know, we're all familiar with Zoom calls, and it's quite a big Zoom call. It's obviously a very important Zoom call. It's with other major New Yorker people, and they were doing a kind of simulation of what might happen after the election, I believe. Different people playing different roles. He was playing the courts. One person was playing Donald Trump, one person Joe Biden, one person Democrats, all this kind of thing. And then they went into breakout rooms. And he went into a breakout room, but it seems that he was on a second video call and he thought his camera was off and he was masturbating.
Hmm. Was he doing it different from what you understand? Because a lot of this is murky. Was he doing it as a joke, or was he doing it as like, hey, look at me? Did you pick up any information about that? Because it seems it's one of those stories that you don't have the whole story. Well, maybe I don't.
It seems that he genuinely did not know that the other people on the call knew that he was masturbating.
Oh.
And he didn't know, and they continued the call.
They could see him masturbating and he didn't know they could see him. So he was masturbating thinking that they can't see it, and for whatever whatever thrill that would give him.
He had no idea. So they're continuing this call. He doesn't know he's being watched, and they're like, okay, let's just continue the call. Then they all come back on the call, and he had no idea he was seen. No idea.
That's Victoria Jones, the executive director of the DC Radio Company. And that brings us to the conclusion of this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at this past week of Monday, October 19th through Friday, October 23rd, 2020. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off. in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in association with Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.